Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, hello. This is Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio, broadcasting live from Roberta's, and I'm your host, Talia Ralph. Low-fat, non-fat, and heart-healthy, we've heard them all, and for a good part of this century, millions of Americans have dutifully avoided the dreaded F-word, fat, in an effort to get slim and steer clear of cardiovascular disease, which is the leading killer in the United States. But there have been some rumblings from the other side. There was Dr. Robert Atkins, who famously advocated for bacon and egg breakfasts. And these days we've got paleo diet disciples and the gluten-free craze. And today on the show, we've got the latest crusader for butter, meat, and full-fat cheese on air with us. Her name is Nina Teicholz. She's an investigative reporter who has written for Gourmet, The New Yorker, The Economist, The Washington Post, and The New York Times. She spent the last decade poring over nutritional studies and interviewing hundreds of nutritionists, public health officials, to get to the bottom of how fat got such a bad rap. And her book, The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet, is on sale across the country tomorrow. But we're lucky enough to have Nina on the show with us today to give us a taste of her reporting and findings. Thanks so much for being with us, Nina.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be on the show.
Awesome. We're delighted to have you. So the idea from the book, it actually came from your time as a restaurant critic here in New York, right, in the early 2000s. So I'm wondering if you can tell us about that experience and how the light bulb went off to turn from food criticism to this nutritional investigation that you embarked on.
Well, the food, I had a little column writing a restaurant review. It was really just sort of a side thing. Then I was also writing for Gourmet Magazine about doing investigative food stories. But this little column, they sent me to restaurants, and they didn't have a budget to pay for my meals, so I basically had to eat whatever the chef sent out to me. And chefs, I discovered, are not interested in sending out stir-fry vegetables and chicken, which is what I had been eating for most of my adult life, and fish. They are interested in sending out the more complex and interesting foods like red meat and pate and cream sauces and foie gras, all these things that I had either never eaten or not eaten in decades. And they were delicious, I discovered. And I also found that I was losing weight and my cholesterol levels were fine. And that was a huge mystery, which then set me off on this huge, near decade-long journey to try to figure out what was going on, why that was so.
For sure. So you wrote about trans fats for Gourmet in 2003, right? And that piece got a lot of attention. And so can you tell us a little bit about what you learned about trans fats while reporting and sort of what the reaction to the piece was?
That was my entree into thinking about fats, which is that I had was assigned a piece on trans fats before anybody really knew what they were about. I wrote this piece for Gourmet Magazine. It got a huge amount of attention. It led to a book contract. But once I started researching fats, I realized, oh, there's just a much bigger story here about fats in general. And, you know, that fat is the ingredient, as you said in your intro, that Americans have obsessed about most. It's the nutrient that has been targeted the most. And I realized there was that all of our nutrition recommendations over the past nearly 60 years seem to have been wrong, and so that was this huge kind of revelation and set me off down this path.
So do you think you're going to have a similar reaction to this book? I mean, it's pretty radical for a lot of people who, you know, like you said, have believed the opposite for most of their lives or devoted themselves to the Mediterranean diet or other low-fat diets. So have you gotten any feedback so far, and sort of what are you expecting as the book hits stands?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that what I'm saying is controversial. And, you know, the reaction is just starting to come in because it isn't even out yet. But I think it's important to note that the dogma about saturated fat and fat has been crumbling, and it's not, I'm the one who has done a ton of research and talked to a lot of people, and I've documented it. But what is happening out there in the nutrition community in general is that there are a number of scientists who have started to question these fundamental beliefs about nutrition, and there has been a body of research now over the last decade where the clinical trials have been done, which really show definitively that a high-fat diet is healthier. It's healthier for heart disease, obesity, and diabetes. And so there's a group of scientists out there who are developing these ideas and testing them, and most Americans have just never heard of them because they're not because of their beliefs. They're not mainstream nutrition scientists, and their names, they're not on the expert panels deciding what to recommend Americans should eat. But there's a community out there that is starting to topple this dietary dogma.
Right, and I definitely want to get to sort of the politics of that in a little bit. But for those of us who don't know, can you sort of highlight why you've found saturated fat is good for us according to the research, and why maybe these low-fat, high-carb diets that a lot of people have been following are not, and sort of how we've been led to believe the opposite?
That's a big three-part question,
right?
But let me start with the beginning one, which is how did we come to believe that saturated fat is bad for us to begin with? And that goes back to the 1950s when the nation was terrified about the epidemic of heart disease that had kind of appeared out of nowhere in the 1920s and had risen to become the nation's number one killer. And there was a need for answers. And there was one scientist, Ansel Keys, who was an outsized personality, extremely charismatic. He got the idea that saturated fats were what was bad for health. And he was able to insert his idea into the American Heart Association. And the first anti-saturated fat guidelines for the nation came out in 1961. Once they were institutionalized, I mean, I'm trying to reduce it as much as possible. Basically, like, institutional science is like an oxymoron, because science requires that you be self-doubting and nimble and that you constantly question yourself. Institutions require constancy, consistency, and not letting your public feel like you're all constantly changing your views about everything. So once the American Heart Association adopted this one idea about what caused heart disease, it became almost impossible to change. The National Institute of Health, also run by a very small group of people who were kind of an interlocking group of nutrition aristocrats who also were the head of the American Heart Association, they controlled all the research dollars, they appoint who's on the expert panels, and that creates its own momentum carrying the idea forward. And anybody who dissented, there were plenty of critics along the way, and there was plenty of bad science that didn't support this hypothesis along the way. But those voices, I mean, scientists quickly learned that if they were critics, they weren't going to get any money to do research, and nobody was going to invite them to conferences or on any expert panels, and that was basically professional suicide. So we wound up with this hypothesis becoming fact before it was ever really tested. Why the diet that then did become adopted, which was a high-carbohydrate, low-fat diet, that has been, the American Heart Association since 1961 has endorsed that diet, and the USDA, our government, adopted it in 1980. And we have all been following that diet. Americans eat 17% more fruits and vegetables than they did in the early 70s. We eat 11% less saturated fat. We have cut back on red meat and dairy over the last 30 years, and we've increased our grains, pasta, carbohydrates, basically. And the problem with carbohydrates is it doesn't really matter what kind of carbohydrate, although it seems that sugar is probably worse. It breaks down into glucose. Glucose, when it enters your bloodstream, triggers the release of insulin, which is a hormone in your bloodstream. Insulin is like the king of all hormones in making you fat. It locks down your fat stores so that you can't access them for energy, and it ramps up the degree to which you store the energy that you're eating, basically, and socks it away as fat. So over the last 50 years of following this diet, Americans have gotten fat. And that's also related. Insulin, if you have too much of it constantly, chronically circulating around your bloodstream, you also get diabetes. And we've also seen that happen in America. Right. I think I answered two out of your three questions.
Yeah, that's a great start. And I think what's one of the things that's interesting about your book is while you do point to processed food and big food companies as being a part of this, there's also sort of a web of more, complicated sort of blocking of this science that is relevant and sort of political shape shifting. And I'm wondering if you could just sort of outline that a little bit as the sort of, I don't know if there's one culprit that you would point to or, obviously it's not that simple, but how do you sort of outline the way this progressed from a political perspective?
So that's a great question, because now we're in a situation where the nation's health has gotten so much worse, and nutrition experts are now increasingly pointing the finger at big food and saying they're the ones who've made us fat, when in fact, big food is no angel. There are plenty of things they do to try to steer the science and influence scientists and influence research, but they are highly sensitive to what the USDA dietary guidelines are, and they follow those. And they've been making food that complies with the dietary guidelines, high carbohydrate foods, and even high sugar foods. The American Heart Association was recommending to the American people until quite recently that we eat high sugar foods, including bottled sodas and gumdrops, in order to avoid fatty foods. So there's a kind of an effort now to shift the blame over to big food. But I think that this story is really a failure of science. Good-intentioned men, scientists, who really wanted to solve the heart disease epidemic, really believed that this was the best possible solution, and just jumped the gun on the science, used incomplete, weak science, and then and pushed that through before it was ready, before it was tested. And it's a failure of science, and that failure, that kind of failure, continues today in science. So it's obviously not a simple story, but I think that the nutrition scientists really play the biggest role in this.
Right, and do you think, too, that perhaps it seems from a lot of your book that it's a really bad case of groupthink, and I'm wondering if you think the fact that we do have a pretty homogenous body of who are scientists in this country. Even you just said, men. We have mostly male scientists, mostly white scientists. Do you think sort of a diversity in the scientific community would have stopped this? And, what else does the community need in order to have more open-minded and challenged research?
Well, it's definitely true that in the 1950s, heart disease was a disease of middle-aged white male men, and the people who responded to it were white male middle-aged senators, and then there were white male middle-aged scientists who undertook that work. I think it's very clear that the lack of women around the table meant women were not tested at all, were not included in any of the early studies. There was no data on women at all. And then when it did come out, it was ignored because it showed that women, which this had been known for a long, since the mid part of the 20th century, women, because of their hormones, they contract heart disease much differently than men do. But women really were not included in any of the early trials or the data, or there was no data on women when the U.S. government decided to back the cholesterol-lowering diet. Women with high cholesterol have actually been shown to live longer than women with lower cholesterol. And the other group that really hasn't been around the table are children. Children, also, all children over the age of 2 have been prescribed the low-fat diet based on 0 clinical trials when that recommendation was issued by the U.S. government in 1986. And they, turns out, children thrive better, have better nutrition, grow better on a higher fat diet. But they haven't been at the table. As for other kinds of diversity, like racial diversity, I think that the basic problem has been that there's a small group of nutrition aristocrats, a small group of people who really control all the expert panels and who are in charge of the studies, in charge of the funding, implement the studies, review the studies. They are the editors of the journals. There's a small group of people who control the nutrition agenda in the country. And that is, it's really about a diversity of opinion rather than a diversity of different races at the table.
Definitely, and we have a lot more to talk about. We're just going to take a quick break. For those of you just tuning in, we're talking with Nina Tighe-Schultz about her new book, The Big Fat Surprise, here on Eat Your Words, and we will be back on the other side.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
All right, welcome back to Eat Your Words. I'm your host, Talia Ralph. We have Nina Tighe-Schultz with us today talking about why butter, meat, and full-fat cheese belong in our diets, which sounds good to a lot of us, I know. She outlines this argument in her new book, The Big Fat Surprise, which is out tomorrow. So Nina, you've been at this research for a long time, 10 years, and I was wondering over the course of it, what was, one of the most shocking things or one of the most, deeply obscured things that jumped out at you over the course of doing this research? You're immersed in the field and wondering what you found that made even you do a double take.
Well, there are so many revelations when you go back through the science and you realize how bad it has been. I've been back through all the science going back to the 1940s and read all these nutrition studies. And there are just endless revelations about how bad it was and how it was misinterpreted and how its flaws were swept under the rug. I mean, just to give you one example of one thing I found, there's a chapter in my book on the Mediterranean diet, and I went through and read really all the literature on the Mediterranean diet and olive oil, and one thing I found was that olive oil, despite the incredible hype, has not been... scientific studies have not demonstrated that olive oil has any special heart disease-fighting powers. Although a lot of money has been thrown at that hypothesis, trying to show that it's true, it just has not been demonstrated. And that was a complete surprise to me, as was the little nugget that I found, which is that olive oil isn't even ancient. When I was trying to fact-check this quote by Homer that I had seen all over the olive oil literature, where Homer had apparently called it liquid gold, and I went back and looked through every Homerian text, and it's not there. What he did say was that there was liquid olive oil in a flask of gold, because olive oil was used not for culinary purposes, but to anoint the body for just to be beautiful and also before athletic performances and athletic competitions. And that olive oil actually wasn't used as a foodstuff until about 150 years ago in Spain and Italy and Greece, which really was shocking.
Right. And I mean, do you think there's something to be said for our food culture here in America, or, some people would argue the lack thereof, being more of a culprit here, or, reason why we are so dependent on nutrition science or marketing or stories?
That's also a really good question, and I ask myself a lot. Like, why is it our Americans were we so susceptible to this kind of science? And I think that it goes back to the mid-20th century, that Americans, they really believed in science and progress, and they also they're detached, because we're a nation of immigrants, we're detached from our own food traditions. We don't have, many of us do not have our grandmothers or great-grandmothers sitting around saying, why are you eating that? or that countries that where people aren't largely immigrant populations, they're surrounded by their food cultures, and they're transmitted and passed on through the generations. Well, we've sort of rubbed the slate clean, which meant that American housewives were much more susceptible to getting their food ideas through nutrition scientists and food magazines who, all those women's magazines from the 1920s on, really, they just were stocked with all this, how to be the modern American housewife. That involved using Crisco and not butter. And it's fascinating to go back and look at those ads to show, like, you know, why don't you give up the ways of your grandmother's spinning wheel and give up lard and butter to use Crisco? But, of course, you know, lard and butter is what Americans had been using and what Europeans used all throughout history. Crisco was invented in 1911.
And what role do you think portion control plays into this? Because I've always felt, you know, like the whole French women don't get fat and those movements looking at other cultures that do have this really, you know, appreciation for full fat or things that we perceive as really bad for us. But the key is the way in which they eat them and the portions that they eat them. Do you sort of examine that at all in the book? Where do you come down on that?
My book is not a diet book. It's really a book of science and history, and I don't go into a lot of how-tos. I mean, in my own personal experience, what science shows is that if you're eating a high-fat diet and keeping your carbohydrates low, you cannot overeat on meat. You cannot overeat on cheese as well. I mean, the scientific, the overfeeding studies they did in the 1980s were just fascinating. They put a stack of pork chops on the table in front of people, and people simply could not eat too much of them or too many of them. Whereas it's very easy, according to the studies that I have seen on this, it's very easy to overeat on carbohydrates. Why is that? Well, there are complex reasons for hunger. It's not just about willpower. It's about what your body craves and needs. So if you satisfy the need for protein and fat, then your body sends a message to your brain saying, I'm not hungry anymore. I don't need to eat anymore. And that's why we think of those foods as being more satiating, which they are. So it's complicated, this whole subject, but in my personal experience and the experience of doctors who have, there's a whole tradition of doctors putting people on low carbohydrate diets that go back to the late 1800s in England, and there was absolutely no need to limit people's portion controls or their calories. There was a natural kind of limit. That's been my experience too. I don't think about what I'm eating, or I don't worry about it. I just don't have any of that stress about food and limiting my food that I had when I was a vegetarian, when I worried about it all the time.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, speaking of the stack of pork chops and sort of the vegetarian lifestyle, you do make a note at the end of the book, stepping away from maybe these ethical or environmental implications of eating more meat. And I'm just wondering that how you sort of account for people who, for a variety of reasons, may they be personal, environmental, ethical, choose to be vegetarian or vegan. You know, what do you say to them, and sort of is it difficult to write a book like this and not get into that debate?
Right. Well, so the first thing I'd say is you can be healthy on cheese and dairy and eggs and not eat meat if that's what you prefer. It's very hard. What they found in experiments on animals, it's very hard for animals to reproduce and to grow well on pure vegetarian diets without any animal foods. It's just harder. It's not impossible, but it's hard. And so, but I think it's, you don't have to eat meat. As to the question, I mean, there are huge ethical concerns, environmental concerns. I think those are all really big, serious questions. And the only answer I have to that is we just have to figure out what's healthy first. I mean, it took me however many, you know, almost a decade to figure out, well, what is healthy? And then we're still, even the nutritionists and scientists are still debating that question we're still vociferously debating that question. So let's settle that question first, and then let's see, well, then how can we implement that in a sustainable way? But we first have to figure out what makes people healthy.
Definitely. I just do think that that's a complicated question that takes into account more than just what's in front of us, but how we're producing it. And definitely there's a lot of literature on that as well. But in terms of the big fat surprise, it isn't a diet book. You don't include recipes. But I'm wondering if you could sort of walk us through a typical day of eating for you, and sort of taking this reporting into account, how you're eating and how other people who would want to eat more this way would go about it.
So in my day, I start with bacon or eggs, sausage. I have, I sort of snack through the day. I don't really sit down for lunch. Usually I have cheese, salami, nuts, all really good foods that fill me up. And then for dinner, we have vegetables, like those non-starchy vegetables, like cauliflower, greens. We also have, in my family, we'll either have fish or chicken or meat for dinner. And what we don't have in my house are we don't have a lot of bread, we don't have a lot of pasta, we don't have a lot of rice. I mean, so what I've just described is a high-fat diet that's fairly high in protein, but it really is a high-fat diet. And I think that's a healthier diet than starting off with oatmeal, low-fat yogurt, berries, fruit, orange juice, all carbohydrates, a little bit of protein in the low-fat yogurt, although low-fat products are always higher in carbohydrates, and then having salad and a chicken breast for lunch, which probably leaves you starving. Maybe you have low-fat salad dressing on that, which is really high in sugar because they've taken out the fat, and those low-fat products are higher in sugar. And then having chicken for dinner. I mean, one of the problems with the diet today of Americans is they're kind of stuck with chicken and fish. Like, that's what they get to eat for all their entrees. And what I'm saying is you can eat other things. You can have a greater diversity of your diet and not have to worry, not feel guilty about it.
Right. And so does part of that include maybe opening up our minds to eating different animals? You know, I was just doing a lot of reading and reporting on goat meat and what a healthy and great alternative that is, or, you know, eating parts of animals that we maybe traditionally haven't in the past been so keen. And when I say we, I mean sort of the average American eater. Does that play into it at all, sort of expanding our understanding of protein and how we get it?
Well, you know, it's so interesting. If you go back and look at cookbooks from the 16th century in Europe, I mean, the diversity of foods, the diversity of different kinds of fowl and animals, I mean, it's so much more diverse than our diet is today. And also, if you read accounts by explorers, missionaries, medical doctors overseas, what they find in, I don't want to say primitive, but, you know, early civilizations of people that aren't eating imported food is that they actually prefer the viscera of the animal over the muscle meat. The viscera, the liver and the organ meat is higher, much higher in nutrients, also higher in fat. And the muscle meat, like in the case of the Inuit in the Arctic, the tenderloin, they used to feed that to their dogs, which is hilarious because we think that's the, you know, the most valued part of the animal. But, you know, we're really upside down today from where humans were hundreds of years ago.
Right. And so we're almost out of time, but just to wrap up, what's the one thing you hope people sort of take away from the book? Or is there sort of a Michael Pollan-esque 7-word, you know, eat food, not too much, mostly plants?
Right.
A conference this weekend, and they sort of did that with eating fish and seafood in America. And so I'm wondering if, you know, you have sort of a couple sentences that people are walking away from the book with in your ideal world.
So I'll just use the Michael Pollan haiku line: eat fat a lot, don't worry if it's saturated.
Great. Well, Nina, thank you so much for your time. We've been talking to Nina Teicholz. She is the author of The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. It'll be on sale tomorrow, right?
Right. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
All right. Bye-bye. All right,
bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. You made me feel so good inside.